and welcome to Popcorn Psychology, the podcast where we watch blockbuster movies and psychoanalyze them. My name is Hannah Espinoza Rimas, and I am a marriage and family therapist, and I'm joined by
Ben Stover, individual therapist.
And Brittany Brownfield, child therapist.
We're all licensed clinical professional counselors, also known as therapists, who practice out of the Ardent Center in Chicago. Even though we are all licensed mental health professionals, this podcast is purely for entertainment purposes and to fulfill our love of dissecting pop culture in all forms. So today, we're talking our first Marvel movie. We're talking about Civil War. And we're going to break it up into anger, identity and guilt, family dynamics, and treatment. So who wants to start?
So we can start. I'll start with anger. When I was watching this movie, there were a couple of themes of anger and revenge that really stuck out to me. There's multiple themes in this movie. It's a long movie, and it covers a lot of stuff. It was a really impactful movie, and it's one of my favorite Marvel ones, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But the themes of anger stuck out a lot, so I wanted to talk a little bit about learning to recognize why it's important to understand that anger is a secondary emotion.
Exactly.
Which, when you're talking about anger in anybody you see, usually anger is a reaction to something as opposed to the primary driving disorder behind it. Like some kind of emotion drives anger.
I mean, because the argument is anybody truly angry? Or are they just, like you said, reacting angrily to another feeling? Because in this movie, even, because the premise of this movie is obviously there's a civil war between Captain America's team and Iron Man's team, and a lot of strife between them. And there is a lot of angry reactions from everybody, but it's all based on multiple different things like despair, grief, loneliness, loss, sadness. I would say probably everyone in the movie feels sad.
Absolutely.
And it's presenting as anger.
Right. There's a ton of guilt.
Yes.
And something that in particular you'll see in men is that as we're socialized, that anger is an acceptable emotion. Sadness is not.
Well, how I always describe it to clients is anger feels like an action feeling. It feels like a verb. Like, I'm angry, I'm going to fucking do something about it. Like, it feels like you have power in anger, you have control in anger, and you're like going to get after it, because it feels like a driving feeling.
Absolutely.
And sadness feels like a passive feeling, like crying alone in your room, being bummed out, getting walked all over, like being a pussy, like if you think of it like that.
Yeah.
And it feels very passive. So I think there's also this, especially for men, like you said, there's way, because anger is more of an aggressive feeling. It feels more acceptable to be angry than sad.
Right.
But also it gives the mirage of control. Like, if I'm angry, then I'm doing something about it.
I don't think that there is a man that I have counseled that I haven't talked about this with.
Mm-hmm.
About this whole idea of anger is the part of you that comes out. And that's most likely because you men are socialized that anger is one of the only emotions you're allowed to have. And so that's part of why that's how your feelings come out, no matter how you really are feeling.
Right.
And which that's part of your experience. Go ahead.
Right. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump you there. What with anger in this movie is anger drives every bit of conflict. It doesn't drive the plot. The plot is driven by the secondary emotions in the movie. Whose survivor guilt or depression or grief.
Mm-hmm,
all of those things are what drive the plot. You look at T'Challa or Tony, it's their Zemo, their grief is what drives them. But what leads to the action is the anger, because that is how they're choosing to deal with it. They're not choosing to do self-care, Tony, who tries to create his own treatment, but we'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
It's the most Tony egotistical thing to do. I'm going to create my own treatment using my own stuff,
Instead of just talking for like $100 an hour to a therapist, that's if he didn't even have insurance, I'm going to spend millions and millions of dollars on a technological treatment.
Right.
But whatever.
Right.
But I was, because classic examples are T'Challa loses his father. There's guilt over not saving him. There's obviously sadness about losing a parent. And then there's also probably feelings of being overwhelmed that now you have to take on a mantle, not just of a superhero, but as a king of your country. And he turns all those feelings and he pushes them into anger and revenge towards Bucky Barnes.
Right. And he targets Bucky to kill Bucky Barnes. That's his whole goal. That's mm-hmm. what's going to make everything better. And it's interesting that you mention him because he's the one at the end
yes.
who shows the insight to
yes.
go.
Yes,
yeah.
My little heart was so proud of him.
Right, he goes through his little his him. Speech of, this solves nothing. This isn't going to make it
like
better.
We're all fueled by revenge right now, or vengeance. And it's, well, he has the insight to look at the whole battlefield and be like, what the fuck are we doing? Like, we're ruining ourselves. And right. I mean, well, and that's true to his character, though, as you see in Black Panther, is he's a pretty benevolent ruler.
That's
yeah,
true.
Yeah. I also think that him, because all of that anger, you don't have a chance to really think about the logical parts of things. So, like, he also didn't consider there was a chance that there was anybody else. Like, he never did any looking so into
then,
it.
Yeah.
So then when he's standing outside of the room while that the bad guy, what is his
Zemo?
Name? Zemo. While Zemo is saying, yeah, it was me, you see Black Panther in the background hearing this and being like, he didn't, had never considered that it could have been someone else.
Well,
he locked in because he was holding on to all those anger feelings.
Because I think also the next kind of trick that anger plays on you is the idea that once you go through the act of letting your anger out, then you will feel relief, not just of the anger, but of all the feelings underneath the anger. Like, if I punch this guy in the face, I'll feel better. If I kill the guy who killed my father or my mother, I'll feel better.
Yeah.
Like, that'll be like an instant. All those feelings will just go away, like taking a big breath after you do whatever the thing is that the anger is telling you to do.
Right. I don't think I'd ever say this to my clients. I don't know. Maybe I would. But I just had a thought in my head. Like, anger is not an orgasm.
Yeah.
Revenge is not an orgasm. It is not.
But that's the feeling people have. Like, it's going to be this great big release.
Right.
And then you'll just be
satiated. And then they'll be calm. Exactly. There'll be a calm afterwards, and you won't have to deal with anything else. You won't have to talk to anybody about the feelings that you're having. It'll just be over with, and you'll be
go
back to normal.
That's a very tempting offer. Like, it's a powerful feeling. It's an action feeling that makes you feel like you're in control. And then it's a feeling that promises you relief, instant relief, that's not going to take deep, deep work and grief and time and sadness and just being in your feeling.
No, like, you do something physical to get it out. You make a target of what is the source of your anger and you strike back at it. And then all of a sudden you've transferred everything, all the bad feelings inside of you, the sadness, the grief, everything that's inside of you, you've transferred it onto this other person. Anger's not an orgasm, trademark.
That'll be our first
really
T-shirt.
Not to make any inappropriate comments, so I'm just.
But that'll be our first piece of merch, bro.
Did it, right.
Yep.
Anger's not an orgasm. Yeah.
But and also, cool. I think the same thing happens with Tony at the end. I mean, what's genius about this villain Zemo? What a name!
Yeah.
Genius about him is that he uses anger as a weapon. He uses other people's anger as a weapon.
Yes.
I mean, he is a genius at being a villain. Like, he knows, he says it the whole thing at the end when he's talking to T'Challa, like, I knew that I couldn't best them physically. I'm not a superhero. I'm just a dude. He's like, but I knew that I could. If I could get them angry at each other and they destroy
each other.
Like, so it's kind of the whole thing's like an allegory about the destructive nature of anger and how it just destroys. It does not make you feel better. Because, the thing happens with Tony as well. He finds out about Bucky killing his parents. And his way of dealing with that grief is through anger. And I need to destroy Bucky now. Mm-hmm. And I will destroy Steve to get through to Bucky. And then probably anger at Steve for not being on his side.
For not being on his side.
And for not telling him that.
Yeah.
Which I did not realize. I have watched this movie too many times, and I did not realize
it's probably unsaid
that Steve knew about that.
You know, I think there's probably a deleted scene somewhere or something.
Okay.
Because they just like mention it like you're supposed to know.
Okay, cool.
Maybe something happened in a comic somewhere that I haven't. I don't know.
Okay.
Like, Civil War was like it was a long comic series.
Yeah.
But the. Yeah, I didn't. They don't show it in the movie that Steve knew that Bucky was the one that killed his parents.
Yeah.
But Steve also says, he didn't know that it was him. He knew his parents were killed by that program. He didn't know that it was Bucky that did it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that makes a little bit more sense to me then.
But even still, that he didn't tell Steve that, or that he didn't tell Steve didn't tell Tony.
Like, this is how your parents actually died. It wasn't a car accident that killed them. It was this whole deal.
Right. It was these people that killed, and he's one of them. So
Yeah.
But he knows, and rightfully, that Tony doesn't manage his emotions well. He kind of pushes everything down and then explodes or finds some way to.
Well, he's impulsive. Tony's just impulsive.
Oh, yeah.
He's an impulsive guy.
And he's just immature. Like, he's very immature.
Emotionally.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so and then what else do we see with anger in this movie? We definitely, I mean, it's just a lot of acting out anger from two people taking sides. I mean, everyone's so defensive about the Accords. Like, everyone just jumps on each other's throat, which is probably a combination of a lot of things. Guilt about,
I think,
about the consequences of their recent, like, civilian deaths. Like, right. Just laying waste to whole communities, basically. At least civically.
Yeah.
Like, who pays these taxes in these communities? This might be me getting, like, old or whatever, but, like, when I watch these movies, I just think, what's happening to the infrastructure? Who pays the taxes to rebuild the infrastructure in these cities?
Right, like Sokovia, where they...
Or, like, D.C., like, he damages a bus. There's, like, a side, like, a highway under an overpass. Like, all that stuff. But anyway, I digress. But, so there's a lot of, I think, defensiveness, anger, acting out, you know, argumentativeness, defensiveness all around the Accords, because I think there's a lot of the underlying feelings of guilt, confusion, like, lack of confidence about who am I as a superhero and what should I be, and, like, what's my place
right
in being a superhero.
And also thinking that their initial thoughts about how to handle the catastrophes that they've been handling, and that their initial reaction may not have been the correct one. And how do they, and what do they do about that in the future? Yeah. How do they stop themselves from just reacting in that way? Like, they always just, like, something happens and they get together and they make a plan, but it's also, there usually isn't a lot of time. And maybe that's because of whatever, the aliens or whatever, happening.
The aliens or Ultron.
Or whatever. Yeah, like whatever. The bad guys.
But I mean, you can argue that the Accords challenge their moral judgments and, like, their belief systems, but it also probably, like you said, challenges their belief in themselves.
Yeah.
And that would make people angry and defensive.
Absolutely. Sure. Of course it would.
Well, and also just the heaviness of having all of the weight of all, like, having, being in a position where people can point at you and say that this is your fault, and just, they can just pick anything because there's so many different things that happen. Like how that woman meets Tony outside in the hallway and her son had been killed.
Which is another version of anger.
Yeah. And she comes up and gives them this whole story, and it's like, right. But then there's so, like, Tony wasn't the only one person who had anything to do with that, but people can point at you and say, you did this and you did this, and then it's all spread out, and it's like, well, what are they, should we just not do anything ever?
Because if they didn't do anything, then the population would be angry that there are superheroes that exist that aren't protecting us.
Right.
And if anyone died in that circumstance, it'd be all the headlines would be, where was Captain America?
Yeah.
Well, right, of course. And I think that's what our soldiers go through, particularly in Vietnam. They went through, it was like, I mean, and even some go through now, is that, you know, they give up everything to fight this impossible evil that most people can't fathom or understand, so they don't respect, because they don't understand how bad that the terrorism actually can be and the types of evil that they do.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't happen here to that degree like it can elsewhere. But when these heroes, They fight impossible evils. They're trying to stop things that are going to cause irreparable harm. Even in this movie, we see at the beginning what, like, starts the whole, when they're in Africa, is they are stopping somebody from getting hold of some biological weapon from a CDC center. And if those terrorists had got hold of that, replicated it, dropped a bomb on a city somewhere or in a subway, like, they had to act now. They had to act right now. And, you know, these Avengers have had to encounter those things. They had to encounter Ultron. They had to encounter the aliens coming in the first one. They've had to stop all sorts of impossible evil.
Yeah. Which I guess the next argument is, too, like, is a lot of this anger and defensiveness come from a place of trauma as well. Like, I have gone through all this stuff. I'm so tired. I'm so traumatized. Who knows how well they're sleeping? You know, they're probably not taking care of themselves. And so, in those circumstances, when you're run down emotionally, physically, socially. Like, they don't seem like they have a lot of social supports outside of each other. Like,
no.
You are more prone to be irritable. You're more prone to be angry, act impulsively, and act out against the people closest to you in anger. For sure.
Absolutely. And all of that can lead to these people who are also, they're betraying roles, right? They're like, they're superheroes. People are expecting them to be larger than life, fill never impossible wrong. Roles, never wrong, never make a mistake.
Well, they're expecting them to be superhuman, like, in the gods. Way that they physically are superhuman, and that they're also, yeah.
And have infallible judgment.
Yeah.
But then when everyone else is angry at the losses they've encountered, rather than deal with their loss and accept, you know, like, that these people have sacrificed for you and have given up a lot and have lost a lot themselves, they point yeah. fingers at them and go, well, why weren't you perfect?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that causes a lot of the conflict we see with Tony and Steve throughout the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, what's right versus what's agreed upon? Like, and should you do something that's agreed upon when you know it's not right?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that slides into our next idea, which was identity. And then yes. guilt orients, like, about your identity
yeah.
and what you've done and who you are. I mean, I think what's always a really interesting question, and I'm sure people have written dissertations about it and have held lectures and Comic-Con panels, is who are you when you're a hero? Like, when you become a hero, like a superhero, how do you define yourself? And how do you keep a sense of an individual self? And when you're a hero, when you're a superhero. And I guess what I mean is, like, who are you outside of being that person? Like, who is Steve Rogers outside of Captain America? And how do you deal with that and be a full person when that's going on?
How do you take the different parts that you have to portray and make it into one identity that works for you?
And how are you, I mean, just how are you a healthy individual?
Well, that's something we deal with every day as counselors, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do you mean? We're not superheroes.
No.
Oh, no.
No.
He doesn't mean us. He's silly.
I don't mean as superheroes, but I mean, like anybody in the helping professional counselors.
Yeah.
Like, we come in, we see clients, and we hear mm-hmm. the worst parts of people's lives.
Yeah.
And we sit with them and feel that and work through that with them, but we still have to go through and have our own lives when we leave our office.
Mm-hmm. But I guess, but the difference is, I guess, in these movies, how these characters are portrayed, it's like as if we lived in the office that we also did therapy in, and that we had to be available yeah. all the time, and we also were, like, seen everywhere as just a therapist, and also, like, we had to change parts of our bodies and parts of our minds to be therapists, and it's so there's not as much room to compartmentalize, it doesn't seem like.
I kind of feel like I'm in between both of your ideas, because I feel like, I don't know, though. Like, the days that I work here at the mm-hmm. private practice, like, I dress different, or then, like, I get ready, like, I'm in my car, I'm like, okay, you're going to go be a therapist, and I'm going to go do this job, and so I don't know. I mean, like, I think in some ways, it is like that. I think the biggest difference is that they are on a universe level, right, where everybody knows who they are, and they have to be, and like,
it's more like celebrity.
Yeah, like, we are beholden to the clients that we see, and to the ethics, the boards that our licenses are under, but like, we're not to the whole
we're not beholden to society in that extent, and held responsible on that level.
No, it's not the same. Yeah. I don't mean to imply that it's the same, or that superheroes at all,
I mean, like, it's interesting to draw what's the differences.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I mean, if you think about with doctors or police or soldiers or any profession, like, when are you allowed to be Mike, and when are you Dr. Mike?
Or mm-hmm. And how do you manage that conflict within yourself in a way that helps you be a healthy, well-adjusted human?
Because I would say, kind of back to what I said a little earlier, is I think what's obvious, why this question came up in my mind watching this movie, is it's obvious that they're struggling and or not successfully creating identities outside of their superhero personas. Like, they're all, like, little lost souls. Like, they're all, like, orphans, kind of. Like, not a lot of them have any social supports outside of each other.
Right, except for... Clint and Ant-Man. So yeah. Hawkeye and Ant-Man, those two, particularly Hawkeye, they make a big point to separate
him. But that also was like an eye-opening like experience. Like it was to draw like such a contrast.
Right, because none of them even knew he had a family.
Yeah, and how that was abnormal. And that was a shocking twist in their group. In their like
family.
Yeah.
It's unknown.
Because a lot of this movie brings up is there's several moments in the movie where different characters bring up. They literally say, "Who am I now that I have this?" You know,
like blank. Almost every character says something like that in this movie.
Like Vision points at the stone in his head and he's like, "Now that I have this and all the responsibility of the Soul Stone, who am I now?" And Wanda goes, "Who am I with these powers?" And then
the sweet little Spider-Man says, "I've been me my whole life. I've had these powers for 6 months. So I'm trying to make it so that I'm still doing things that I would normally do because I don't know what the expectation would be with those added powers.
Like, I can't play football now because I didn't play football before."
Right. It would be unfair. It wouldn't be, is it right? Like, they go through a whole moral conversation.
Well, it's all like, how are you authentic self? If your authentic self, well, one has to stay, some parts of it have to stay a secret.
Yeah.
And then if your authentic self, I don't know, if your full part of who you are is so, I don't know where I'm going with this, but like, so beholden to society. I don't know.
Well, I think that's what Captain Rogers struggles with the hardest. It's like his whole identity is based on being able to go in and solve the problem and just deal with whatever he thinks right, take the moral high ground. Mm-hmm. He's coming from World War II where it is unquestionable. Like,
They know who the bad guys are.
We're the good guys. We go and we take care of it. I know I'm on the right side.
And all of the destruction is so that we can have what we hold dear, our freedom and our rights and whatever at home.
And stop people from being murdered.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I guess when I watch it, and this is me being like a hella therapist, is I'm just like, how are they taking care of themselves? Like, I'm watching it, and I'm like,
I know.
And also why this, like, this stuff becomes so heightened for them is so much of who they are is tied into their job. Like, if someone put a lot of limits on my job, I could walk away from my job. You know what I mean? And I wouldn't necessarily feel like I was letting down the world if I stopped being a therapist because of restrictions upon being a therapist.
But when you started, did you feel that way or did you struggle with it? Because that's something that I know when I've had interns or undergrad interns in particular, because I remember even when I was an undergrad intern, like you start forming your identity, like this is who I'm going to be. Like, oh, there's problems. There's my friends who are a couple are fighting, or my friends are having an issue with drinking or whatever. Like you... A lot of people struggle with that. Like, okay, well, now I've been, like, trained to deal with this, so maybe I can help. But then you have to set boundaries on that where you're like, no, hold on, that's my profession, though.
Yeah, I could see how people would, how that would be a thing. I don't know that I know that I struggled more with it maybe it was in grad school. But it just seems like for me now, knowing that I can't help everyone.
No.
Because that's... And I can't give parts of myself away because then I won't have any left for me. So I feel like I have learned, but also I've been in the field for a while.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess I could see. I remember struggling with feeling confident about being a therapist and with having to being looked at as an expert in a room when I had just, you know, I've been trained, but like I hadn't had that much experience with actual clients.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, I think I definitely had identity stuff with, like, thinking I had to have all the answers for clients, but I think that's also part of, like, lack of confidence, and also
but
people
I also think
kind
that's
of make putting you in a position of why don't you have the answer, so I think that just comes with getting more confident.
I think that's a normal progression that happens, thinking that you have to have all the answers.
And I think that people who are in any profession probably go through that. Like, when you start, like, look at somebody's going to school for IT and your computer breaks and you're, like, don't know what to do, and, like, I don't want to pay $200 for this. Hey, Jim, what's wrong with my computer? And like, he's like, dude, that's work, man.
Yeah.
Like, that's my work. But then that person might feel compelled to fix it. I just wonder, like, with these heroes in this movie, if they kind of go through the same thing where they're like, they're still...
They
have their identity, but then they're in this world where they're these heroes all the time and they're expected to do hero things all the time. Like, what happens? How do they turn that off? How do they
change their identity? I think Steve has a hard time with that. And I think agree. Part of that is because he really wanted to be that person when he was pre-serum, when he was small. Mm-hmm. He really wanted to be a hero like that. And he was always in fights and defending people and getting it over his head and wanting to serve, like trying to enlist so many times. And so I think he has maybe, arguably, maybe a bit of inferiority complex about that stuff. And then... I also wonder now that he has this banging bod, like he has this like really strong body, if he feels beholden because he has been given a gift by the government of being really strong and able, that he feels like it's selfish to walk away from it. I wonder if like that's part, and so his identity is maybe a lot more tied together. Whereas it sounds, feels like Tony, maybe because he created the identity himself, is wanting more distance from it and is better able to do that. Like, he definitely seems like, in Ultron and this movie, that he is trying to get away from being Iron Man. Like, he's trying to find a way to end all this stuff. Because he has an argument in Age of Ultron where he's like, isn't the point of Avengers so we don't have to do this stuff anymore? Like, not to keep doing it. Yeah. Whereas Steve's like, right. Let's keep doing it. And he's like, no, it's not. It's like, because it seems like Tony is getting tired of this identity.
Well, Pepper's getting tired of it.
Yeah, and that's what I also wrote. Like, it's like he's shifting from being sort of like the egocentric playboy to wanting to be a good partner. And so part of that's figuring out, how do I compartmentalize my identity of Iron Man into something where I can be more giving to the other parts of my life? And it seems like the other people on the team, minus like Clint, you know, and Scott, are very enmeshed in the world. Like, they don't really seem like they compartmentalize personal life. Like, even Natasha's like trying to get Steve to date, and he's in like one of the earlier movies, and he's like, no, I'm not ready, like, and she, you know what I mean? So it seems like there's a lot of, probably because they have trauma, probably because they have all this emotional stuff they're not dealing with, that there is like they're just like kind of keep retreating into the world of being a superhero with each other.
Yeah, well, and it also seems like, and maybe it's just because that's how they make the movies, but it's because there's so many things happening all the time. They don't have a chance to, like, really figure out who they are socially and really have more natural supports out in the world than just the people that they are working with all the time. I mean, I think that there's also a part where they don't have a lot of time for that, and it's clear that they all need time for that. I feel like this movie really shows, has a really good example of what it looks like when you don't take good care of yourself. Like, really poor self-care, not being aware of any of your needs, or and just kind of
throwing yourself into one aspect of your life.
Yeah, throwing yourself, and also kind of really being pushed by the trauma that you've experienced.
Because you could say also with Steve that he has survivor's guilt. Like, you know, a lot of the people that, when he was back in the 1940s and being Captain America, a lot of the people that served with him died, like on his team. And so probably feels beholden, like, I have to keep holding the shield up on their behalf.
Yeah, all those people died. His lover became, you know, when he was back, she's in her 90s or 80s or 90s, and she's dying, and then he's interacting with their children, which, I mean, he doesn't find out
until later. Like, the niece.
Yeah, her niece, and then he's Howard, who built his shield and did a lot of stuff. Tony is his son. He's interacting.
Also, as a client, and how would you think it's a red flag if your client was Steven Rogers and he's like finally starts dating somebody and you're like, oh, who is it? And he's like, it's the niece of the woman I've been obsessing about since I was frozen in ice. And you'd be like, oh, yeah. Is this growth? Well, ?
I think, Brittany, you'd have to first evaluate, like, you were frozen in ice?
Well, I mean, like, let's say we've already, like, acknowledged.
Are you just acknowledging that's real? Okay.
Assuming that we like, live in the Avenger world. Like, if he was just, like,
your client, and you're just, like, the on-staff therapist in Avengers Tower, which he rolls in, and you're like, oh, you're finally dating and getting out there making social sports, and you realize that the person he's dating is, like, the niece of the woman he was attached to from back then, I'd be like, are we making sure we like this girl for who she is, or because she's the closest version of what you've lost? And that's identity stuff.
Yeah. Well, but he didn't know, so.
But still.
He knew when he kissed her.
Oh, yeah, he knew when he kissed her, but he wanted to kiss her beforehand.
Inferred.
Inferred.
And then I would say a lot of the other stuff I see in this movie in terms of identity is also, who are you when a lot of people are scared of you? Like, there's a lot of conversation movie about Bucky and Wanda.
And
them being like, who am I because I used to be a quote unquote bad person, and I used to do bad things for bad people, and people have made a lot of decisions about who I am, and people are scared of me, and people have decided I'm bad. And how do I work through that? How do I move past that? And who am I when I decide to be different? Can I be anyone different? And that's a big identity thing for both those characters in this movie.
And even when I'm trying to be different, there's a chance that the people are still going to treat me like I am bad. And so the outcome is still going to be detrimental to me. So then I still have to act in a certain way so that I don't get killed.
Well, it's like Wanda being kept in the tower.
Yeah.
And like everyone being kind of nice to her, but also, but kind of bullshitting, like, we're just trying to protect her. But what really is you're, you know, you're isolating her, and you're keeping up the narrative of you are dangerous and we don't trust you.
And even the Avengers, as the Avengers family, we don't trust you.
Yeah.
Right. And how much bigger of a difference that is of her being also shunned in some ways by her people.
Mm-hmm. Like, you should be the people that understand me, and you're even scared of me.
And give me support and help me understand these feelings as you have all been through this. Instead, everybody's walls are up because everybody is acting out of trauma and anger and guilt.
And then in the beginning of the movie, she does accidentally fling that thing into that building and kill people.
Right.
And then
she's dealing with tons of guilt.
So there's the continued guilt of, like, can I be a good person? Because I keep fucking up. And I think Bucky's even a bigger version of that, where it's been 2 years, I think, since Winter Soldier. And so he's, I'm assuming, just been kicking it in Romania, or probably been living in different places and trying to be regular. And, I mean, his whole thing is, I wrote down when Steve comes, finds him, and they're in his apartment for that big fight that happens.
Right.
He is like, Bucky, it's okay. It can be different this time. It doesn't have to be a fight. And Bucky kind of, like, deep sighs, and he says, it always ends in a fight. And to me, it made me think of all, like, the teenagers teenagers I've worked with, who that kind of level of resignation and hopelessness about who they are and how people treat them. He very much reminded me a lot of those kind of kids I worked with, which is, everyone thinks I'm bad already. What's the point? You know? I can't be a different person because everyone already has decided who I am. Like, I'm already a problem at school, and every time I make mistake, I get in trouble with the principal and with the teachers, and I'm always getting suspended because no one trusts me and no one believes me. And what's the point of trying to be better if there's no reward for being better because everyone's decided who I am? And then you get stuck in this. I mean, he kind of gets out of it in this movie because he has the continued support of Steve believing in him. But a lot of kids, if they don't have that, they just get stuck in that, well, I might as well just keep on keeping on because I can continue in the narrative of being negative, but I have no guarantee that I can ever be positive because no one's believing that I can be. And so then you start to identify with that as well, which I think Bucky does too, which is like, this is who I am and I'm never going to be good.
Yeah. And then he starts to get Steve accepting him, like you said, and then, Sam starts accepting him, and then
they're very sibling-esque, which we'll get to later. But
and then so does Scott. But then something that comes up for me when we talk about like identity and guilt is you're on some good points there. But what I think is interesting is when we're talking about that is watching Zemo, and something that struck out for me is when people lose, like, you know, he lost his whole family. Like, you see him, you don't realize he's listening to a voicemail.
Yeah, until the end.
Until the end. That's like a voicemail he saved. It was, like, the last thing of his family. And it's, like, his wife telling him about how his son misses him. But something that... one of the therapies that I really like, which is... my brain just stopped working. We're going to forgive that part. But
psychodrama?
No, not psychodrama. Same. It's
psychodynamic?
It's from...
Archetypal?
No, from...
Jungian? Freudian?
No.
Gestalt?
Logo. There we go. Brain works. Logo therapy. So one of the things from logo therapy is that you need to learn to find meaning from suffering. And this guy loses his whole identity, he loses his family, he loses everything, he loses his country, and he locks into revenge. He doesn't adjust, he creates a new identity for himself out of anger.
He almost has no identity, because then after he gets done with the revenge, he plans on shooting himself in the head.
Right.
So he's a non-person to himself now. He is not anyone anymore.
Because he doesn't know who he is without being connected to the people that he loves.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then one of the things that I thought was interesting with that is, while we're talking about identity, is logotherapy was created by a psychiatrist who was in the Holocaust. And he learned to create that after he lost his wife. And he learned to recognize, you know, like, the people who survived, the ones that create meaning and purpose and new roles for themselves, even out of suffering. What do I do? I went through this. How can I share this with the world? How can I make the world better now because of this? How can I remake the world so this doesn't happen again? And applied that type of theory to treatment as a whole. And I just thought that was as interesting as we talk about, like, the heroes, but also the villain is driven by the mm-hmm. same inability yeah. to adjust to an identity change. Because that
yeah. and that's
is
very,
what fuels the anger.
And that's very common with grief and loss. Like, especially if, like, say you lose a child and you're no longer, quote unquote, a mother because you don't have a child anymore. Then who are you? Because that was your strongest identity before that. And are you still a mother after your child has died? You know what I mean? And it's kind of trying to reframe who you are after a major event. I mean, with all these people, a lot of it is, like, who am I after I get powers? Who am I after I become not sick anymore? Like Steve, you know, who am I after I've lost all my, like, my family? And who am I after my dad dies and I become a king? Like, all the people in this movie have had their identity majorly shifted by a big event that either they chose or did not choose.
Right. Or Tony, how do I
stop being Iron Man?
Right. How do I stop being Iron Man and go back to being the inventor that I am? Like, how do I go back to that life? And you see
and
him trying.
And he can't stop himself. Even when he didn't bring his suit to, like, when he was just wearing his, like, his button-down suit, he still had a little watch on his hand to turn his hand into an Iron Man hand.
Right.
Like, he can't stop himself. But that's also, like, him weaning himself off, you know, because there's also an addictive quality to an identity sometimes. Like, I really like the attention of being this person, or I really liked what I got out of being that thing. And so to get...
Or I feel a lot of worth having that identity, or people seem to recognize me in a different way, or mm-hmm. I get my needs met by having mm-hmm. this identity.
Because, I mean, that could be also the argument with a lot of these, and maybe why the Accords is so scary to some of the heroes in the story, is like with Captain America again, does he know who he is if he's not Captain America? Because before he was Captain America, he was this sickly, small kid from Brooklyn who couldn't even take care of himself.
Right.
And so if you slap these Accords on me and I don't have that, and I don't have a family, and I don't even know the time, I'm out of my own time, like, who am I, and how dare you take that from me?
And I'm just trying to help.
Yeah. And so you can't take this one thing I have going for me away from me, or at least put hindrances around it, or make it feel bad, you know,
right.
by labeling it, like, destructive.
So we got a lot of identity and guilt, and a lot of that drives the plot, and a lot of these issues are what, like,
well,
what we talked about in the beginning, that's what creates the anger, right?
And it splits up the teams, too, because it's the teams of the people who are struggling with their identity and wanting to cling to it in some fashion or reframe their new identity. Like, why Wanda kind of goes towards Steve is because she wants to be a hero, and Tony's making her feel like she's still a villain.
Right.
And Natasha is trying to be on the right side for once.
Because after, like, S.H.I.E.L.D. fell.
Right.
She was like, I thought I was finally a good guy, and I'm just another bad guy. And so, with the Accords, you know, it's probably, I want to be on the right side for once. I can't pick Hydra again, incidentally, or the wrong side again.
Right, or be a Russian assassin where I, you know, like, was mm-hmm. sterilized and went through a whole ceremony and then gave up my whole life to be this murdering assassin for my country.
Well, she just wants to be a good person and
right.
be on the right
and
side.
She just wants to help.
And because she's even like, I mean, I would argue, and I don't know if this is maybe because she's one of the few women in this movie, is she seems the least anger driven, which goes to your statement of, like, it's more of a male endorsed feeling or a male appropriated feeling. Is like, she stays pretty cool and calm and kind of playing both sides the entire movie. Like, she doesn't feel driven by anger at all. Even
no.
when she's arguing, she's kind of just discussing.
It's interesting, like, you see her like that, and then Rhodey is like that too. Like,
mm-hmm.
both of them tend to stay the most emotionless, the most, like, level-headed. Mm-hmm. You don't see a lot of the...
I just started.
Angry Birds.
Well, that Hannah's excited because this kind of gets into our next part, which is family dynamics.
So the way that I split them up, I kind of gave everyone a role in the family of because for most people, where we learn our role is in our family, and so I think that what I was seeing a lot of is these different characteristics of how even when, like, I'm the oldest girl in my family, and even when I'm not in my family, I still act like an oldest sister.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm the oldest sibling as well.
So,
me too.
So having that part and kind of thinking about this in that way, so I have that the oldest brother is War Machine, whose name I did not know that was his name until you just said it, and that's why I look confused. And the oldest sister is Natasha.
Because they're both pretty much peacekeepers. They're both trying to stay calm. They're both trying to get everyone to see the side of reason.
Right.
Which is usually an older sibling trait. Because, I mean, if we're going to go full-blown with it, it's that, you know, Steve and Tony are mom and dad.
Yeah, Steve and Tony.
Steve and Tony are definitely Steve mom and dad.
Steve and Tony are mom and dad. And then we have, and Bucky is like the half-brother that you didn't know maybe existed. And then the step-brothers are T'Challa and Clint. Sorry. And Clint is like an uncle.
Because he just comes in and he's like, because he just kind of
comes in, and which is probably just because they don't develop his character as quite as much as they do everyone else. So just knowing that, so then that's kind of how everyone acts, and also knowing that they're also all trying to find their roles. And so when they're together, they don't know exactly how to act because a lot of them have acted alone for such a long time. So kind of putting them into this dynamic of this family of where they all have roles, it's really hard for them to connect to each other and also to be able to express their emotions with each other. I mean, there's so many different things going on all the time for them. And then also to have this was kind of like the family is getting divorced. And you have to pick.
Absolutely.
And which can happen in families when the divorce happens, the kids take a side. Right?
Right.
And so I would also say that that Falcon, whose real name I can't remember. Sam. I only have Sam. That's what his name is. That Sam is like Steve's favorite child. And with Iron Man, his favorite is probably
Peter.
Yeah, there we go.
The baby of the family.
Oh, yeah. And he's the baby. So just seeing how they take sides and how they also try to be peacekeepers and how that just has an effect on how they all interact. And part of what, when we get to treatment, I'm going to talk more about how I would be able to try and help them with all the different feelings and roles, but just how it's so, we all only know how to play a certain role, and having to, and getting into this family when you're in a different spot can be really hard. And how do we manage that?
Well, I think a point I brought up earlier is they all are kind of, well, you said, like, they're all pretty isolated people individually. Like, not a lot of them have outside supports.
No,
a lot
they
of
don't.
Them, none of them really have living parents.
I mean,
nope.
The one with the best development is T'Challa.
Yeah, and he
by
he had
far
because he had
far,
loving family.
He had a loving family. He's in the supportive,
but he's
really
not
safe
really
place.
But I would say the Avengers are a family like that because all they have is each other. And so you naturally fall into, like, you know, whenever you are at work, you fall into, like, a work family situation. You know, how many times do people joke that they have, like, a work wife and a work husband? Because we, as human beings, as we like to tribe up and, you know, we are social creatures, we will form family groups in
really
whatever
any
setting we're in the most
any
of.
Setting.
And
yeah.
So it makes sense that the Avengers become a family, you know? And what's also hard about that is when you have been an only child or an orphan person or a solo person for so long.
Or been frozen for 70 years.
Yeah, it's trying to, and even before that, his parents were dead, like, he didn't have any siblings. Bucky was his only. And so trying to get back into a family unit where you have to compromise. You're not just yourself anymore. And so it's learning how to communicate, learning how to have conflict and go to the other side of it. Which they kind of do, not really, though, because even though Steve does do the whole, like, leaves a burner phone and is like, I'll always be there for you, it's still not a resolution where they can come together at the end and be whole again. Like, it is this sort of, there's so many conversations that are deal breakers within them.
Yeah.
Right. No, it's like they plant the seed, but then they certainly don't show, like, the full resolution. You see it starting to form when we get into the most recent Avengers movie, but then that's a whole nother can of worms, and we'll do that one when that's a complete saga, because that's half a story. We can't.
But you start to
see how those seeds being planted can start bringing things back together.
Right. I mean, there's the whole scene in the conference room of the movie. Well, there's several conference room arguments, but when he gives him the pens, the really fancy pens, Tony gives Steve the fancy pens, and he's like, they're almost come to a compromise, but then they kind of start talking about, if we're going to get real deep into this metaphor, like they start arguing about their kids because they both have different ideas about how to protect their children, which is
we
need to protect them by keeping them in the tower and by distancing ourselves from superheroing and by, you know, having a lot of structure and rules. And Steve's like, no, because then you're making them feel like they're not good people. Like the Wanda thing was a really big clincher. He was like, you're making Wanda feel like a bad person.
Right.
And he's like, I'm protecting her. And he's like, bah. And that's an argument.
She's like the black sheep child of the family, where they're like, well, we have to protect her from herself almost. And like her situation, she's different. She's got this situation where she's not even really a citizen. So she doesn't even really belong here. So she's here because
Steve was like, you can go fuck off and your pen too. And I would say too, Bucky's almost like the problem child kid in the family.
Yeah.
Where you get in this struggle a lot when you're working with a kid who has behavior problems, where one parent takes up too much. Like Steve's always defending him and backing him up and trying to rescue him and make excuses. And the other parent is like, no, he needs to be disciplined. He's bad. He's making bad choices.
Right.
He needs to be punished. And then that's a real moral. That's a really hard conflict to work through, because that is like a moral fissure. Like, how do you?
Well, it's really hard because then in the couple, so then you get to this down. What it comes down to is one parent really feeling like they're right, and the other parent really feeling like they're right,
and there's
no middle ground, and there's no way to communicate a compromise because they're both stuck in this idea of what they think this child is. Again, stuck in the idea of the identity of the child that they have together and what their hopes and dreams for that child or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. And so having that, they come together and there's no talking about it. I mean, they can't talk to each other about it. So then even having them like in couples therapy because they're not communicating, they're not getting past the point of who's right.
Yeah.
And the difference really is it doesn't matter who is right. It matters how this is all making you feel. Do you feel like you want to be connected to someone when you're just yelling at them about your child? Does that make you feel?
Well, also,
just all of those things.
It links back to our first topic. I
imagine you see this in family therapy a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This scenario probably is something that you see play out in family dynamics a lot, where you have to figure out how all these parts fit together and make a whole machine.
Absolutely. I mean, like, it's called there's structural family therapy, and then there's just even just family systems is about how the system works. And when you have, and how the system is different and changes as there's more children, or as there's a child who has health issues, or there's a child who has behavioral problems, and how does the system change and move to accommodate that? And is that helpful, or is that saying this is a bad kid, and now we have to change the structure of the family to be like, no, this is a kid who's struggling, and what can we do to support them, or what can we, how can we help them, and how can we really change this? And so I think that, Steve and, what is his name?
Tony,
god damn it. Steve and Tony are just so stuck in this, and also Tony really backing off and really feeling a lot of guilt and shame about the things that have been happening as his role as Iron Man, and so him really taking a step back.
Like, I haven't really been the protective father that I thought I was.
Yeah, and I
but I need to be.
But I really want to be now, and Steve being like, look, we're doing the best that we can with what we have. And we just need to continue to show these people who they can be and help them develop to the best kind of people that they are. Instead of putting fucking bars around them and telling them that you're not allowed to do these things unless this other entity, like this high school, tells you what they're allowed to do.
But what's hard about this in this universe is that they don't realize that that's what they're doing. That they're both have taken on parental roles within their unit, within the Avengers. Yeah, and they're having like an argument akin to, we have different parenting styles,
basically,
and we don't know how to compromise.
Which is
a common conflict between people who don't discuss that stuff before they have a kid, which is, I want my kid to flourish and grow into their own, and but I want my kid to say yes ma'am, no ma'am, and have good manners and not be a little shit. And so, you know, and
which is part of what is really hard about second marriages. A lot of times a second marriage, there's children from another marriage, and not having those conversations about what is it going to be like when we have this other, when the family system changes and now there's two children who have another parent, and how does this whole thing shift? Because that is really hard. And people, I think there's a lot of discussions that don't happen around the change in a blended family.
Oh, there's a ton of discussions that don't happen. And there's also a ton of redefining your identity now that people have to go through, because you're not just like you used to have this identity of where you're dad to these people, but like you have to be dad and stepdad and figure out a way is bridging the gap to dad and dad possible, or is it going to be dad and stepdad, or is it going to be dad and Tim? Which are you going to be,
and how hard that is. Like my own personal experience, I was like a parent to my siblings with my mom, and then when I would go and stay with my dad, I was a child, and I was like, nope, not interested, and I would fight with my dad. Or whenever I had to change when the kids have to change their role, where I'm no longer, like you said, dad and Tim, like now I'm dad and Tim and Sheila and Chrissy or whatever, made up a bunch of weird names, and what does that mean about me, mm-hmm. and my feelings and how and what happens?
Yeah, I mean, because a lot of the fights, when you start thinking of it like they're two parents, like I encourage everyone to watch this movie again and think about Tony and Steve as two parents fighting over their kids. Because once I had that locked in my head, fight they had, I was like, Mom and Dad fighting about their kids.
Yeah,
again.
Like I did it in, like in, about in the middle of the movie, and just like made this whole list of who I thought everybody was, and then we just kind of like watching the movie like that. It just seems like two parents who can't get their shit together about how they want to parent their babies.
They have one kid that can understand Wanda and they don't know how to help her. They have another kid, Bucky, who's a troubled kid, and they're like, one wants to write him off, which does happen sometimes. If behavior stuff gets sometimes so bad that I've had parents be like, I think we need to get rid of the problem child in some fashion for the sake of the health of the family. And I think that's kind of what Tony is like.
Send them to residential.
Yeah, or like, we have a foster kid and we need to get rid of him because he's too detrimental to the rest of the family. Or adopted kid or whatever.
And I feel like Tony looks at Bucky exactly like that.
Like, this is Steve's kid who's fucking up our dynamic.
Yeah.
He's bad news bears. He's gonna make everything bad. He's too much trouble. He's out of here.
But Steve loves him too much and he can't see and he can't let go and he can't just change it. Or he's like the friend, like your kid's friend whose parents left, and so now you're raising him, but now he's part of our family now, but you mean only kind of, he's expendable.
Right. Yeah.
And Bucky's always going to know that.
Which is kind of like, and you said, like that. Being like the half.
And feel that.
And which, feel that.
Yeah. Feeling, that's why I said half brother, because it's that idea that you're connected, but also you're not. And also you're accepted, but you're not in the same way. And how a lot of times the other parent really has to do a lot of work for themselves about how their expectations and how they feel and how they're making sure that they're,
I mean, we could even go farther with the metaphor and be like, when you introduce a new kid into a family system, who is going to be the parent, like you said, but more like who is going to like actively parent? Yeah. Like if they let Bucky stay with them, would Steve be the one in charge of Bucky? In terms of if Bucky does do something wrong, is Steve the one who has to discipline Bucky and put him and make sure he has structure? Is Tony allowed to say anything, or does he just need to give Steve the power with that?
Absolutely.
And that's something that I think causes a lot of conflict when I've worked with families where incidentally or even intentionally, the step-parent becomes a disciplinarian to their step-kids because they're the one that's around the most because of work. Or just because that's their style. They think as soon as this kid is part of my family, I'm allowed to boss them and parent them. Or sometimes the biological parent will be like, I never told you could do that and you need to step off with disciplining my kids.
I would blank stare at my stepmother whenever she talked to me. I'd be like, yep. Like, just because I'm like, I don't know who you are.
But people don't think about that when they think about blending families. Like, the nuances of how do you discipline the kids that aren't familiar to you? Do you discipline them at all? And so all of this kind of, I know it's all around the accords, all the conflict and signing it or not, but a lot of it really is, how are we going to raise these Avenger children?
Right. Well, and how are we going to
lead them
when now we're on the radar? So now, like, if you're going to stick with this, it's almost like Secretary Ross has come in, and he is now almost like a DCFS agent going like, hey, guys, you know, this government body of the world here in this situation came in and went like, hey, you knock it off.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to come and we're going to visit you every month.
And we're going to be in your life now.
This house better be clean. There better not be marks on the kids. They better not have gotten in trouble in school. Like, you guys have to be on your best behavior for me to trust that you can take care of these kids. And Tony's like, oh, okay, like, well, whatever you want. We'll do whatever you want, play ball. And Steve's like, not my house.
Right. Not what I want. These are my kids. Fucking kids, and I'm going to do what the fuck I want.
Right.
Yeah. And you have to trust that I know the best. Trust me to take care of the world. Why don't you trust me to take care of my kids?
Like, I know what I'm doing. Don't boss me about my
And
children.
Also, the other idea, the thing that just popped into my head is the other idea is that there's more people that come in. And all of a sudden, now there's more roles. And there's Spider-Man. And there's Ant-Man. And there's a lot of these other people. And how do they all come in and then have this role? And how does that change how everybody feels?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Poor Natasha is like the big sister who's trying to mend fences. Like, I know that as well as an older sister. Like, you do kind of like, probably older sibling period, is you just kind of like try to like put your hand in every pot, but like on the sly, like be like, hey, buddy, I really think that if you talk to dad, he'd, you know, I think he'd listen. And then you like sidle up to dad and you're like, I really think that Steve's having a hard time, and if you would just kind of like talk to him, I think he'd really appreciate it. And I think that's a natural role big siblings, peacekeepers have.
Yeah.
Which is you kind of like covert, which she does that exact thing. Like, is Big Sisters like that? And then I was thinking, there's something I did the exact thing like 2 weeks ago. And so I was like, because you never stopped being a big sister.
Right.
And it is this,
you know,
thing
I did, I stopped being a big sister.
Yeah, and became a big brother finally.
It was a hard day. It was a hard day.
I support you and all your choices. But because she does that thing where she goes to Steve the funeral for Peggy, and she supports Steve, and she's like, even though I don't agree with you, we're fighting, I want to know that I want to make sure you know that I still support you. Like, she really does take the high road.
She really does.
She accepts him for who he is, which is all of these people need their feelings validated.
Right.
As people.
And that was a big shift for her. Like, you look at her, she's an assassin. Like, this is a whole shift in identity. Maintaining her identity and neutrality. And the only time she, like, starts to break from that is when she starts zapping T'Challa when he's trying to kill Bucky.
But even then, she's like, come on, guys. She's like, let's all just be in this together. I wonder, too, with her, because of her backstory, is this, maybe this is the most stable she's ever felt. And she's like, I'm going to preserve this family unit.
Exactly. The most safely connected that she's ever been to people. Because it seems as though, and I don't know that much about her because they haven't made a fucking movie about her yet, which is outrageous. Well, not soon enough. That she, how much she has even been allowed to be connected to anyone else. Mm-hmm. You're an assassin. You're just watching your back all the time.
And I'm sure she was probably recruited at a young age, like the typical stories like that.
I mean, like Red Sparrow is.
I literally said earlier today, I wonder if they delayed Black Widow because Red Sparrow came out and they were like, well, that's the same fucking movie. God damn it.
That's probably exactly what it's going to be.
And also it's like two colors with an animal name, Red Sparrow, Black Widow.
Yeah.
Too similar. Anyway, I digress. But. And I think that, and even when she's fighting, when they're all fighting at the end, like in the airport hangar, like, she and Clint aren't really fighting.
They're kind of just, like,
fighting.
Right, they're pulling powers.
Because they want to preserve their family unit. And it's not important to her. Like, everyone else, she's one of the few people in the movie who is not, she's not being motivated by anger.
Right.
She's, like, she just doesn't have that going for her, so everything for her is more motivated by family togetherness and wanting the unit to stay together and be compassionate and be supportive. And so even then she's fighting, but she's not really fighting, and everyone else is like going to town on each other.
Right. I think, is it Wanda that calls
yeah,
him, calls
him yeah. out? She, because he like, she like blasts Natasha and she was like, you're pulling your punches, to Clint.
Yeah.
And he was like, whoa.
Yeah, he just looks at her like
Clint, even Clint coming in and taking a quote-unquote aside, he's still like trying to kick it with like have like back and forth with Tony and like back and forth with everybody else from both sides. Like he's still trying to be like you said, the uncle, like the jokey fun uncle who comes in and he's like, come on guys, let's all like hang out.
Right.
Bringing levity to the situation.
Right. But then it all changes when Rhodey gets hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because when they stop.
It's the reality of the situation too.
Right. Which you can see in families, if something like somebody gets hurt, something changes, somebody's ability changes where now the focus of what's going on and it being about everybody's shit now has to switch because yep. something changed.
Because a family member needs support in a different way and we can't be squabbling over things that don't make any sense and we have somebody who needs our help mm-hmm. and we need to be there for.
Mm-hmm. So we got all these characters. So there's a lot of treatment things to discuss. There's so many characters. When we move into our treatment section here, what do we want to focus on?
Well, I mean, kind of continuing on with when I was talking about like identifying Bucky as kind of very much resembling clients I've had.
Sure, with the kids.
Which
yeah.
is like a teenage boy mm-hmm. who has probably heard for years now that he's a bad kid because of bad behavior. I would even argue that because he's done a lot of bad things because he's been not in control of himself, which is also a metaphor for a lot of kids I work with where they might have anger issues because of trauma, abuse, mental health, you know, mental health diagnoses where they do things impulsively. They do things out of anger where they feel out of control
mm-hmm.
and they don't realize what they've done till after they've done it. And, you know, and then they have all this guilt and shame surrounding that. And then they get labeled a bad kid. Like, a lot of kids I work with get labeled as behavior problems when it's emotional issues.
Oh, yeah. There are kids that I worked yeah. with that are just like that in residential. And you would see a couple of things that we're talking about is, like, what happens when mm-hmm. they do get removed from the family to get treatment and where it mm-hmm. switches. So, and yeah, I'm with you. I'd see the same thing.
And so, and I've worked with kids as little as 7 or 8 who have already been written off in this way. Like, and not, I mean, their family still love them, but the language that the family will use with me is, he did it again. Like, he's always making bad choices. Why can't he do this? There's all this, like, and I understand because they're tired and they're over it, which is, why can't this kid get their shit together? Is he not a good person? And they don't say it like that.
Right.
But no, they don't.
But that's the feeling. Is my
well,
kid,
kids
like...
Because kids pick up on all of those
yeah,
things.
Yeah, and so a lot of what I'll do with parents is, you have to get away from the behavior and you have to talk about the emotions and... You have to, because Bucky, to me, because probably because I was seeing him like this, he looks so scared all the time. Ugh. He looks scared and
oh, yeah,
anxious.
Yeah, he's scared of himself.
All the time. He looks so vulnerable.
So vulnerable.
And probably, and even when Steve tries to approach him with love and tenderness in the beginning, it's like he can't go there because there's no, because here's the thing. When you ask someone to be vulnerable and change, they have to have assurances that there's going to be positive ramifications from changing. And so what I'll tell parents is you have to give the kid one opportunity to be positive. And then when they do something positive, even if the little thing, you have to give them praise for it.
Yeah.
And you have to try to get away from negativity.
Well, it's also in a
and
way
like, don't
to
shit
help
on them
feel safe.
And all, and just be, and every time they make a good choice, be like, I really appreciate that you did that today. And even if it's something stupid and little, like they, when they got in trouble and you put them in timeout, they went into timeout the first time you told them.
Right.
Be
right.
Like, that, thank you so much for listening to me. Here is, like, even maybe just a thank you, or here's a little token, or, you know, just acknowledging that they were following directions. And that can be the building block, because also when a kid gets that hopeless and kind of just becomes that person, like, mm-hmm. I'm just a bad kid, so I'll just fucking go for it. And I'll just
yep.
be the baddest I can be, because
yep.
at least that's, I've got that.
Yep.
And is it can be really hard to find things to praise in the beginning. And so what I'll work with parents is stuff like that. Like, if you have to send them to timeout and they stay in timeout for 2 minutes, go in at the 2 minute mark and praise them for staying in timeout for 2 minutes. And then come back in 2 minutes and say, thank you for staying in timeout for 2 more minutes and listening to me. And really find, like, stupid little shit to praise. Like, thank you for brushing your teeth. Thank you for, you know what I mean? And make them feel like they can earn positives, that they are choices that they make during the day that are positive. Because I think we get so stuck on the negative
yeah.
that
of
we
course.
Don't see the positives the kids do anymore.
Yeah.
Like, there's 20 things the kid might do that day that seem like things they should be doing anyway, but they are positive choices they're making. Like, they choose to brush their teeth. They choose to go to school. They, you know what I mean? And so praise them in all those situations so that the kid can have more can feel more built up. Like, oh, I do make positive choices. Because also, when a kid gets that stuck in thinking that they're a negative person and that all they do are bad things and all they make are bad choices and stupid choices and aggressive choices, they don't notice that they make positive choices all the time.
Right.
And so you have to reframe for them and emphasize for them. You do make positive choices. You went to school today and you only got in trouble in 2 classes, but not 7 classes, like not all your classes. So you like you have to find the opportunities to praise. And that can feel really, I mean, I've had parents be like, what? When I tell them like, you should praise them for that. But then once that kid starts feeling that and internalizing that, oh, I do make positive choices all the time. I just didn't realize that. Then there's more. Well, there's more of a guarantee that they're less hopeless. That.
Right. And then there's buy-in.
That's what I meant. Like, yeah. They're like, oh, when I do make positive choices, I do get praised. Because what happens too is the parents are so wore out and tired that when the kid does do something positive, no one notices. You know, or they finally did something right. So why should I give him praise for finally making a good choice for once, for fuck's sake?
Right.
And I know the parents love them, but I think they get so wore out. That's the energy that comes across. And even when I worked with kids intensively, it is hard not to be like so exasperated with them because the kid's just in your face or doing something incorrectly all day, every day. And so it can be really hard when there is a moment of doing something right where you just want to be like, well, fucking finally.
Yeah.
You need to be like, thank you so much for doing that. I really appreciate it. And making them realize that there is hope to get better.
Right. And there's build the bridge, be the bridge, not even just build it, but be the bridge.
No, show them that you can see that they are good. Because what it is really is that you're showing them, I can see that there's good in you, and I believe in you. And I think why that's so powerful with Bucky and why he's able to change is because Steve is that parent for him. He's like, no matter what you do, no matter what you say, I believe you, I support you, I will take care of you.
I think we need to get you a green lightsaber, Brittany.
Why?
You're definitely like Luke Skywalker to Vader. I can feel the good in you.
Yeah.
Well, you've lost me there, nerd.
I was thinking the same thing, though. High I was five. Like, oh,
oh, my God. But I think that's something that definitely I thought of in treating this movie is, because also, which ties into the anger stuff we talked about, is also, because a lot of those kids will feel very angry, and that's the only feeling that they know. And so teaching them, so when they're having an angry moment, being like, no, I want, what's the other feeling? What's the feeling underneath? A lot of times with kids, I'll call anger the blanket feeling that because it covers every other feeling.
Right.
And I'll say, no, but what's the underneath feeling? And so then the kids will really have to ponder and be like, what am I feeling other than anger? And there's always something else there. And then continuing to go on with it, with the identity, because what you're really doing when you give the praise is you're building a new identity for this kid. Is I can be a good kid.
Right.
I'm a
good person. You have to completely reshape and reinforce that and help them believe that, hey, you know what? Like, that person that you've been being, like, those behaviors that you're doing, those are just choices.
Mm-hmm.
They're not. You're not a slave to that anger. You're not that identity doesn't have to be who you are. And just because people start reacting to you, like, that's who you're going to be, which is, that's a sticking point. Mm-hmm. It's really hard because if you've demonstrated that you can be violent, people are going, or hurtful in some way or explosive, people are going to react to you as if you are going to be explosive, and they're going to be already on a guard, and that can be hurtful and angering to kids or people that have had that issue before. And you have to let them have their range of emotions and have tolerance for them to have the same range of emotions as everybody else without reacting to it like it's about to be a catastrophe, because then you take away their ability to have normal emotions, and that's not fair.
Yeah, and I mean, and in this situation specifically, I would say with Wanda and Bucky, if I was like to having to like consult the whole team on how to handle them, like as a like the on-staff therapist, I would say you really need to stop dwelling on the stuff they've done in the past. You need to start fresh. So that's one thing. Because that's what I talk about with parents. You need to stop holding on to the things that happened already.
Yeah.
You need to give them a new, like, and then also you need to really notice the things they do that are positive and give them praise. You know, don't focus on, which I think Vision tries to do. He tries to redirect and make it about, like, the good things about Wanda. But then he kind of, like, shits the bed with saying she's dangerous, kind of. But, and that's where it goes wrong.
Stopping because her from leaving.
So you have to stop reminding the kid of the things they've done wrong.
Yeah.
And you have to move forward. And so in those situations, I would just tell the Avengers, you have to keep a positive reframe. You know, you have to support them. And when they make mistakes, don't dwell on it.
Yeah. I think with me, for what I think would be the thing I'd want to focus on is just the anger in general that goes around and looking at, hey, I don't know if there's a specific character that could, because they all show it and they could all benefit from the same things. You'd have to approach it differently. But no, normally we pick a specific character. I think I might pick Zemo if I had to pick a particular one. Like, but looking at the, like, the anger is that people are putting so much energy into being angry, and they're fueling that fire, and they're allowing that to breathe and that to become their defining identity, their goals, and they don't put any focus on, okay, but how, no one's like stopped and gone like, okay, how are you generating awareness of what's actually going on in you? Like Brittany was talking about, like, you have to go like, okay, but what's the underneath thing?
Yeah.
Like, how do you generate, for adults, you'd use mindfulness.
Using all your oxygen towards this one emotion, all this anger.
Right. Mm-hmm. All of it. And then, like, you'd want to work with people on, like, the one thing that he hasn't done is he's taken zero responsibility for his role in this. Like,
which is also the revenge fantasy, which is, I have no accountability because someone made me mad. Made me mad is the classic statement everybody makes of every age.
Right.
So once someone makes me mad, it's carte blanche.
I'm allowed to do whatever I want.
Right. I call out my clients, I talk about it as the fuck it button. And that's the way I use it. I don't say that with kids, usually, you know.
Clearly.
I find another way to say it. But with adults, I will describe it to, like, where did you press the fuck it button? Like, I come up with this, like, concept of, like, look, we're talking about anger here, and there's a point where you decided that, you know, inside of you there's a part that can become a monster. There's a part of you that lashes out and is angry and hurtful, and there is a part of you that lets that out of the cage. And there's a point where you justify that and you make it okay, and you make it someone else's choice. Like, it has to be your choice every time, all the time, and you can't let that become something that someone else can let out of you. It has to be you to hold.
People of all ages have such a hard time with that ownership.
They do. It was hard.
It's this whole thing where, I mean, like I said, like the amount of grown-ass people, amount of people generally who say, made me mad, and don't think about what that phrase actually means.
Right. It's like, I have one client who, I come up with this idea, like I made him, I printed out a little picture of a goat and I made him put it in his wallet, and you're like, no one gets your goat. No one gets your goat.
Oh my God, that's like if a dad joke was a therapy technique.
You know, for this particular client, it was the right kind of
thing.
But
that's the thing, though. We find, right?
It's,
we
take, also adorable, Ben.
It is. Well, we also take the things that we have and we shape it to how it can help someone.
Right.
Right?
I mean, and the way, so, I put it.
And the fact
it,
that that works for someone is awesome.
Right, well, and it helps, like, it helps him understand that, like, okay, like, this is a part of me.
Exactly.
And this is mine, and it's my responsibility to take care of it. And if I give someone else that, then I've given it away and I've lost.
And it's accepting that part of yourself and accepting that we all have different parts and we can make different choices about the parts that we have.
Well, also sometimes, not to hijack what you're saying, but like when I work with someone, probably like this emo who feels like I'm taking back control.
Right.
Of losing all my family by controlling the Avengers and making them fall apart, is what I'll tell to people is like, no, when you're saying that someone else is, you're doing something because of what someone else did, you're giving them all the power. When you punch someone in the face because they made you mad, you're acknowledging that this person made you do something,
pushed you so far,
made you do something against your own will, and you have no responsibility for it, so they have all your power. And once you put it in those terms, people get really like, they don't have my power, because anger makes you feel like you're in control. And when you use that language, though, you're admitting that you had no control. And so what do you want? Right. Control or no control? What are you taking ownership for here?
And that's a, no one gets your goat. And with other clients like who are more focused on internal control and able to understand it, it's like, okay, look, you decided, you pressed the fuck it button. I like to talk, I don't know if you guys have seen Goldeneye, but or all the classic movies with the nuclear bombs where you have to turn two keys at the same time, flip a switch up and then press the button. You have to go through all these steps. Like, I walk people through that with like anger levels. Like, look, this is you, like, and another part of yourself going like, hey, fuck this guy. Like, he's pissing me off, or like, she's saying all this stuff to me, and like, if she's gonna let this happen, like, no, that's you giving yourself permission to launch the nuke. That's what you're doing. And you have to think of it that way. Of like, I'm about to unleash the mass destruction that's inside of me, the anger that I'm capable of. It has to be you locking on to this is me. I take responsibility for it, and I am pressing the button. And the minute you make that something you understand, or you can get a client to understand that, you see massive improvement with anger, because it stops the blaming, it starts encouraging self-care, it encourages people to take care of their emotions and learn to take responsibility for their actions and not make excuses.
And also, because when you take responsibility for what you've chosen to do, there's appropriate shame connected to that. Because Correct. When you act out of anger and then give, like, you're like, they made me, like, give them the power of that decision, then you don't have to feel ashamed of what you did. And shame is what makes us change a lot of our behaviors. And so once you finally acknowledge, yeah, I was the one who made the choice to punch that dude in the face, it doesn't feel as great as saying that guy was a fucking asshole and I took care of him. You know, that feels more like I was a big man in control, and the other one's more like I was out of control and I'm ashamed of myself. Like, that's two different energies.
It is.
And once you acknowledge that, then you're like, well, I don't want to be that person. That feels bad when I reframe it like that, and I want to do something different.
Right. And one of the ways, another treatment you can do to kind of bring that out, one of the things you want to work with anger is actually, like, making people rehearse situations. And you can do that through role-playing, but you can also do that through a technique called psychodrama, which is something that I did some studying in and will continue at some point. But with psychodrama, the whole idea of it is basically therapy through improv acting, where you have to go through and you have to pick people out of a group that most remind you of the targeted person. So if you had an interaction with your dad, or your dad was a certain way, and there was someone in that group, male, female, old, young, it doesn't matter. It's the person whose energy can most capture that person. You pick that person, and then you reenact that scene. You see Tony doing something that is basically psychodrama with his BART treatment.
Barf.
Think of a better. He makes a comment about it. Yeah.
Oh, I thought he said BART. Okay, so barf. Yeah, he makes this super thing where he can relive this scene in his mind, where he can go through and he can replay the actions he did, so he can say something that's more palatable to him than whatever it was that he actually said that he holds on to in pain. With psychodrama, you can do that in a group with other people. You can reenact that whole scene. The director may switch and make you play the part of your dad, so that you have to take on your collective unconscious and use that to understand the role of dad.
$5 words there, son.
$5 words. There's the Jungian stuff. But you, collective unconscious, we'll use buzzword time. I feel like today is brought to you by the collective unconscious, right. The letter U, and our sponsors at WBEZ. But with collective unconscious, it's a concept that we all have the ability to understand certain things, and just through our genetics as having been on this planet for a long time, and it gets passed down, and the ability to assume different roles based on different situations, and that we all have access to this information, but you don't use it all the time, and you only sometimes use it when you assume certain roles. And with psychodrama, one of the theories with it is if you can break someone out of the role that they've been playing and make them play the other role, they have to use those collective unconscious, I don't remember the right word for it, there's a word, but you have to use that energy to play that part. You can't be dad and insolent child at the same time. You have to switch, and then
you have to step into those shoes in order to play that part and try to understand the role of the dad instead of the role of the child.
Correct. And
it's enlightening in a ton of ways. One, you can develop empathy for the other people in the drama. And two, oh my God, I just lost my train of thought. But two, also, like, you can get get perspective on what you really think about the other person. Because when I've seen psychodramas, it's always interesting how when a person plays another person, how skewed their perspective is of how that person behaves based on how they really behave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then what gets really interesting about it is when someone gets it wrong, like their perspective is it wrong, and then the director makes them switch so that they have to play that part and be that ridiculous, and then it starts to correct itself throughout the drama. Or it just provides relief because it allows that person to finally assume the role they always wanted to play, so they can stop replaying it in their mind over and over and over again and just get through it. Because, you know, sometimes if you have a conversation with somebody and you end up, like, talking to yourself and, like, replaying that conversation and going, like, God, I should say, like, you're just such a fucking asshole. And I just went, like, okay, like,
But then, like, maybe it is, like, well, that wouldn't have shaken out, like, how I thought it would. Once I actually say it, I feel bad.
Yeah. Or that's another part of it.
Or it just created more conflict, or I didn't feel like a winner after I said it.
Right, because the other person is going to assume their collective unconscious, and they're going to react to it as if it's happening to them because they're assuming that role of your person, and you've now explained what your mom or your dad or whoever you're wanting them to portray was like, what made them tick, and you've shown them their mannerisms. They're going to pick up on that and be able to mimic it enough that they're going to respond close to a way that that person would have, or the director's going to make you flip roles so that you get it as close to what it would have actually been like as possible. It can really do some amazing stuff.
Who would you do a psychodrama with in this movie? Who would you pick to do it?
Tony.
Tony, with just about the family stuff?
With the family stuff, for sure. Tony, T'Challa. Like,
T'Challa?
Yeah.
With who?
Being able to say goodbye to his dad.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, that'd be a good one.
Mm-hmm. Or like, ugh, Bucky would be hard.
Bucky would be, well, Bucky's
I don't know if he'd be able to. Even talking to his other self, in a way.
I think Bucky would be hard because he has a lot of wild variables, which we haven't even touched upon, which is he's been hypnotized.
He has amnesia,
maybe dissociative symptoms. Induction. Like, his brain, we don't know the healthiness of his brain right now.
Yeah.
And the linearness of his thinking. Like, exactly. Even
it would be hard to do something like that with him.
And how much memory he even has.
Yeah, exactly.
And how he relates to other people, because we assume he knows Steve now, but how much does he know Steve?
Yeah.
Like, how strong are his connections to Steve?
Well, it seems like he's still doing a lot of reality testing with Steve and being like, did this happen? Yeah, I remember that. Did this happen? And, like, kind of trying to figure out his past in that way as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I've been thinking about it a lot about what I would do in family therapy, and I think first I would have Steve and Tony in as a couple, and we would talk about some stuff, and we would talk about expectations and having expectations that make sense for the family that they're in, and how they may need to adjust those, or how they can talk about it in a better way with each other.
Well, because I know we're talking about it like a family, which might seem silly, but office politics and office strife when they're like office therapists.
Yeah.
In corporations, I'm sure they do something very similar, if not the exact thing as family
therapy. One of the classes that I took in grad school was about consultation, doing consultation as a therapist in a business setting.
And helping. This is a business, kind
that's,
of.
Well, and that's the other thing, is that because we learn our roles in a family, that's a role that we take on. And so when we get into a bigger system, we then have to find our role. And a lot of times we continue to play the same role that we always have. And it's when we have to change, or we butt up against the dad, or we butt up against the sibling that we're with. Like, it's all kinds of things like that can happen. So I think I would try to have the parents talk to each other. And then I think I would have all of them come together and try to figure out the best way to help them communicate, or even do like the family sculpting, which I think I've talked about before, where like Steve picks out, maybe not Steve, Wanda has to place everybody in a scene and then talk about what everybody's doing and what that looks like and how does that feel and how are they feeling and how are you feeling sitting over here, and kind of place everybody, and you physically move their bodies to how they're standing and shape them. That's why it's called sculpting, and shape them into kind of a scene of of what it's like at home, and then you talk about that, and that really draws out. And I've in my internship did this with a family of 7.
Okay.
And seeing how everybody has a different perspective. So kind of the same idea of the psychodrama of how everyone has a different perspective, and having somebody else in the family say, this is what it looks like to me. Can you help explain that to me? Or this is how it feels when I'm in my room by myself and everybody else is out here doing all these things, and how I feel separated from the family.
And I wonder with her too, if it'd be like, no one looks at me.
Yeah.
Because they're scared of me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, would she have everybody turned away from her? And so it gives you a really good sense of what is going on and how you can help them change the dynamics in the family, or change the structure of the family, of how they're interacting with each other and how the system is working, because it's dysfunctional. It's a dysfunctional system. And how can we help it be a healthier system where everyone's needs are met?
Mm-hmm. For sure. I mean, just basic family communication too, probably. Like,
yeah.
How we talk about our feelings.
Well, how we talk about our faith, how we identify our feelings. How do we identify to each other that we're being triggered? I mean, in a family like this where there's so much trauma.
So much trauma.
We haven't even really got into.
No.
No, but side note, we did that on purpose because so many of our other ones have touched on trauma. We acknowledge that these characters have had extensive, immersive trauma.
And what we're kind of touching upon, the anger, identity, family dynamics, are all of much influenced and resulted from
absolutely
all their individual traumas.
So even helping them as a family figure out the different triggers that they all have and how they can help or how they can help each other be more present to what they are experiencing and what they are feeling.
And taking a step back, I mean, a lot of this situation,
everything's so emergency focused,
is because people aren't backing down and giving each other space to breathe.
Yeah.
A lot of times when I've done couples work, what you also will try to teach is, like, how do you ask for a break during a fight to take a 5-minute break and come back after 5 minutes and regroup?
Which is, it's huge. And in families, that's huge. One of the most important things with that, though, that I would want to mention is to, when you do that, it can't be, I'm walking away, fuck you.
Yeah.
It can't be, we're not talking about this ever and shutting down. It has to be, we're taking a break and we'll talk about this again in 20 minutes.
When I work with couples, we plan out a sentence that they say. So this is what you're going to say, and then I have them say it. And this is how does that feel to the partner? Does that feel like something that will work, or does it feel like it will just heighten the situation? And trying to find the best way, because so many different things are about communication and how we connect with each other and how we get our thoughts and feelings across. And if there's no way that we know how to do that based on our experiences, then we have to help people figure out how to do that together.
Well, if they didn't have role models of how to behave differently, then you have to be the role model as the therapist.
Yeah.
Well, this is a different way you can behave. Like, you don't have to fight a fight all the way to the end in that moment.
Right.
Or you're walking away from the fight, or you're, you know,
being
a wuss.
Showing that you're backing down or something. Right.
Like, you can walk away and then come back to it, but you have to. I mean, the number one question I asked after a couple has a fight, and they said that they're fine now, is I go, well, did you resolve it? And a lot of the times they'll go, we're not fighting about it anymore.
That was yesterday.
But what came out of that argument? I mean, ooh, like, did you decide something based on what you were fighting
about? Are you
going
to make a change? Is there anything
and
you're going to try and do differently?
A lot of times we walk away, we blow off the steam, but the problem won't feel as heightened because we don't feel as emotional. But it's still there, and it's going to come up later. Because also what happens in this movie is every fight is built upon the last fight.
Yeah.
So every time Steve and Tony get at it with each other, it's just not that fight.
God, I feel like I would just, like, do mindfulness with them as a family and be like, let's just take a fucking breath together and just fucking be here and just know that we accept each other and that we all love each other. And let's just take a breath. This has been so fucking stressful becoming a family and so hard.
God, there's a meditation that I will use with clients, with the right clients. Again, not with children, but with adults. There is a mindfulness meditation on YouTube called Fuck That. A mindfulness meditation. I felt like you were just citing it. It's almost like, take a deep breath in. Allow yourself to recognize that all this fucking bullshit is fucking nonsense, and allow that fucking nonsense to melt away from your body. And for the right client, adding that bit of laughter and swearing at them can shock them into actually doing it.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be like, wait, did you just say fuck? Like 10 times? Like,
yeah.
I did just say fuck, I said fuck that, this fucking bullshit.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And it actually can, like, shock people and laugh and makes them go like, this is fucking bullshit. Isn't it? Like, you know what? I'm just going to, let's take a second and breathe here and relax.
I wonder though if you could do, I feel like Steve Rogers would be affronted by the not taking it seriously. Like,
here's the thing. So what I would do is I would see them in couple session and get him to have some buy-in, and then I would, because here's the thing, he would do it for his kids.
He would do it for Bucky, and
he would do it for Bucky.
He would. Well, and I also feel like that one would be one that would go over really well with Tony.
Oh, he'd love it.
Yeah, Tony would be pumped.
He's like, this is my kind of therapy.
And Tony would be like, Steve, come on. Like, we're just going to try this. Will you please just try this?
Will you stop being such a fucking square?
Hearing Vision say that would actually probably make my life. It would be so fun.
Yeah. I just feel like If there isn't a staff of therapists that work in that building, I don't know what's going on. Because there's so much trauma.
Yeah.
All those people in that movie are a mess. And they need somebody to talk to who's not one of them. Because even Sam is technically a VA counselor. But he's still part of the team. He has too much bias. He can't be the therapist for them.
No, he can't.
Well, it's not healthy for
them. They just
need
a regular schmo who works there. Probably several of them, so they don't all have the same therapist. And that's what they need.
Yeah.
All right, so we've talked a lot about this movie. Indeed. What are your final thoughts?
I love it.
I love this movie. I love this movie.
It's a fun movie. It's a lot of good action. It's a lot of good emotional beats.
A lot of hot dudes.
A lot of hot dudes. Hotties versus hotties.
I've watched it 1,000 times.
But I think it's also...
Put the girl boners away. All right.
Listen. Now,
there's no way that's going to happen.
Yeah, no. Not with this movie. No.
No. But also, it's just a good...
Guys,
it's a
Chris
good
Hemsworth
movie.
Isn't even in it.
It's fun. Yeah, I know, right?
But it is a really... It's a... And I just have a sweet spot for the Steve and Bucky dynamic. And I just want... Whenever I see movies where someone is downtrodden like that, I just want to be put my arms around him and be if just one person would just be I believe in you,
yes,
then he'll get better. And I think it's sweet because Steve does do that for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I love this movie. I loved all the Captain Americas. Each one got better. If I had to pick at the top of the Marvel tree, because now there's 15 movies or something?
I don't know, man.
There's a lot.
There's
10 years. But
yeah.
Winter Soldier and this one still ring in right at the top for me. They're just so
good. The action scenes are the best, I think, of all of them.
Oh, absolutely.
I think they're the most hand-to-hand combat, real, impressive looking ones. They're not mystical and magical. It's a lot of just hand-to-hand fighting.
Oh, yeah. Well, Cap 1 was on they were playing it safe because they were starting out okay, we're doing Captain America. We really got to get this right. And Captain America punching Nazis. But then... the combat that started coming in with him and Black Widow at the beginning of Winter Soldier and continuing into this one was hard-hitting awesome.
And I love that Black Widow does not become a love interest. Because here's the thing. I said this when we were watching earlier
today. She
does
for Hulk, though.
She could have so easily been Steve Rogers' interest. They could have been a very will-they-won't-they dynamic. And because here's the thing. This is me being real cheesy. Steve Rogers needed a friend, y'all. He didn't need a girlfriend. He needed, a friend.
He did.
He's just fucking lonely. I like that she is a friend, a bro friend for him.
Yeah.
And she's trying to set him up with girls. She's trying to, give him a normal-ish life. And maybe because she's had such an abnormal life, she's one of us has got to...
Somebody's got to get their shit together.
And I don't know if it's going to be me.
I think is the most interesting part of who they set up his love interest to be is she was on a show called Revenge.
Oh, yeah.
The whole movie is themed around Revenge, and they use his love interest as the main character from Revenge.
Well, it's probably because they're just both so blonde and beautiful and blue-eyed.
She is definitely brown-eyed.
Oh, yeah, she just
calm down. Okay, now who's got a boner? All right.
Gross.
They give you two. There's two. There are two girls in this entire movie. It is all dudes, all jack dudes, where the rest of us guys are going like, all right, I'm never going to look like that ever unless I work out for 6 years.
The lady does protest too much. But anyway, I do think it's a really, they do a good job of having really good characters, really good character arcs without losing it to the cheesiness or the action.
Yeah.
They don't phone them in.
No doubt.
No, they don't. Everything is great. All right. So that's going to conclude this episode. I hope you guys really enjoyed this one. Please follow us on Instagram, Facebook, on Twitter. Reach out to us. Send us an email at popcornpsychology@gmail.com. We're very responsive. We love to hear your guys' thoughts. We love to hear your suggestions for what you liked about the podcast, what maybe we got wrong, or what you had a different opinion on, and what you'd like to hear next. So until next time, enjoy.